early on a Friday morning in May this summer, I was just made it into the office. I got a phone call from our bridge engineer. He was very concerned. He'd been keeping an eye on this project or on this old bridge for several months due to the crack that was underneath.
That's Brian Kidwell from the Missouri Department of Transportation, recalling the moment it was brought to his attention that the Grand Boulevard Bridge, you know, the one downtown that crosses over 670, was in bad shape, like really bad shape.
Immediately drove out here, and he started showing me the crack, and there was a big sag in the top of the deck, and live traffic was still going underneath. It was real easy to know that we immediately needed to close this thing.
Which they did, luckily, before anything happened. In just a few months, they tore down the old, cracked, sagging bridge and built a new one, a project that would normally take a really long time, but the city and state worked to move it along, and now, voila, new bridge.
So congratulations, everybody. No scissors? Yeah.
Right.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR Central Standard, we're telling the story of bridges in Kansas City, Missouri, from the first bridge, the Hannibal Bridge, built in 1869, to the most recent one that just opened on Grand Boulevard. We've got 13 bridges in all, if you count the rail tracks that go over the river, and most of them have been built and demolished and rebuilt at some point in their lives. We'll get to that bigger story shortly, but first, artist Jim Woodfill is here to talk about his work on the Grand Boulevard Bridge. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Gina.
When you were commissioned to work on the Grand Boulevard Bridge, you treated it as an extension of a project that you began in 2006, involving lots of bridges in the downtown Kansas City highway loop, where streets like Baltimore and Walnut go over the highway.
Yes. It was a project that was ultimately titled Pedestrian Strands, and it was a collaborative design public art project with El Dorado and a number of players involved in putting it together. And it was a great experiment in public and private cooperation with a grant from the Gary Dickinson Family Foundation that helped finance it as a public art project.
So it was, the idea of strands is kind of interesting. I mean, if you picture the downtown Kansas City loop and then think of those bridges as like almost strings across a guitar or something.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about, I mean, what you envisioned with this project that the Grand Boulevard Bridge now in some ways completes, though unexpectedly?
Well, it does. You know, if you remember prior to the project, it was scary walking across those bridges, the narrow sidewalks and the low guardrails. And the process for us in thinking about it was to cooperate with MoDOT and the city in widening the sidewalks and making it a pedestrian experience to restitch together and strands or stitches, right? The kind of the highway gash between what was then the startup of Power and Light and the crossroads. So it was an attempt to really create another layer of a crosshatching of the city and kind of repair the disconnect that had happened.
What do these strands look like? I mean, in your words, as an artist, because we've talked about it on a sort of practical level, like what it does for the city, but art is a part of what's going on here.
Yeah.
So tell us what it looks like.
Well, I think what it looks like is a place where there's a highway underneath and there's movement going in many directions and many different paces, and it's kind of an orchestrated view of the inner workings of moving around the city.
What is orchestrated about it? I mean, what I notice are shadows.
Yeah.
Why am I noticing that? What did you do to make me notice the shadow? I mean, you noticed shadows, kind of silhouettes of cars and people moving across these bridges. But why do I notice that?
Well, we're playing a lot with different layers of transparency in both the fencing that are in the guardrails. Sometimes that's layered up, and sometimes it's different degrees of of transparency. We've put
that glass. I mean, what is the material?
The glass. The original pedestrian strands was comprised of the mesh and then the glass panels, which had photographic interpretations. I guess would be a good way to describe it, of embedded in the glass. So images from surrounding buildings, images from the backs of the highway signs were all kind of manipulated and embedded into the glass. Some of that is retained on Grand, and so the east side of Grand is actually a photograph of the windows in the top of the ballroom at the other end of this corridor, and it's abstracted, and kind of the color is moved from one end of the corridor to the other in that way.
What does that add to the bridge experience? I mean, why not just have a bridge?
Yeah, well, I think it gives the whole area a sense of place, a sense of specificity that.
This is a Kansas City bridge versus just a bridge.
Well, this is a bridge right here that's gone beyond, above and beyond what a normal bridge. It's gone above and beyond what a normal bridge aspires to, and it's trying to be a partner with the rest of the city around it, as opposed to simply the infrastructure. And that's something that I've been looking at for a long time, and my collaborations with El Dorado are usually geared towards taking mundane and everyday infrastructure up a notch.
That's interesting when you think about the idea of, I mean, you've mentioned that this loop could feel like kind of a gash in the city, and that you've kind of filled it in with images of the city, like to... Yeah, filled in a hole.
I think so. I think it's real interesting. When we first did the first iteration of pedestrian strands, there were a lot of gaps in the landscape around it, and that is filling in. And we came back. Main Street had to be replaced a couple of years ago to facilitate the streetcar. And so we kind of upped the ante on Main Street and added sound buffer panels into the mix of the kit of parts that we were using. And that's extended onto Grand now with the big kind of really transparent blue panels. And the whole west side has sound barrier panels.
Why sound barrier panels?
Well, it was an interesting find, right? That we got out there and we put these glass panels on the bridges when we first started, and we noticed such a distinct difference of the highway traffic noise as you were walking across. You walked in front of the glass, and it was quiet. MoDOT was interested in exploring this material, and El Dorado working on Broadway Bridge with Derek Porter. That was the first time that these had been used, and I think the first time they'd been used in Missouri.
You know, Jim, you've done a lot of artwork in public spaces, art involving what I think it would be fair to call industrial materials, as well as color, light, movement, and shadow. It's subtle in a way that, say, a mural is not. I mean, you don't necessarily walk by your contributions to a space and say, ah, that's art. I mean, you might notice the place around it differently. That's a more likely response. I mean, how would you say that what is it about your artwork that makes people notice the space around it more than the art itself?
Well, I think I'm really interested in ambient change in an environment, and for me, the site of pedestrian strands, the arena, the Star Building, those are all part of the composition, and I'm simply using the tools that I have available and the things that I can that I can manipulate to fine-tune the environment. So I'm not particularly interested in a kind of a monumental presence of public art. I'm interested in retooling the experience of place. And so my composition intentions go beyond the physical things that I put there and extend out into the environment around it. Is that?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I have a feeling that a bridge is different in some way from other pieces of functional infrastructure, but I can't quite put my finger on why that is. I know that when I'm approaching a bridge often, and then when I'm on a bridge, I get this sort of like majestic feeling sometimes. Not that I am majestic, but that there's something majestic about the experience. Yeah. Do you share that sense?
I do, but I share that in a lot of different kinds of places as well. I think long ago you and I walked through the crossroads and parking lots. I find a lot of spaces that inadvertently become majestic.
Yeah,
as you'd
I mean
say.
That conversation, we were in surface parking lots and the crossroads, which at that time were abundant. They're still by some measures abundant, though decreasing. And I remember I had a beef with all these surface lots, but you referred to them as viewports, that you could stand in a surface parking lot, look toward an alley, and see kind of the city opening up before you in a way that in a more dense city you wouldn't.
I think that's right, and I think it's not that it's a good thing to scrape buildings, and it's not that it's a good thing that the highway cut divided our city, but those are the things that we find. Those are the conditions that we see when we're out there. And how do we make the best of those, and how do we build from those previous decisions? I think you'll find pedestrian strands as an attempt to do just that. That you know, there's been an ongoing effort to consider capping the I-670 corridor, and
what do you mean, capping it,
putting a lid on it, and making a parkway
over the top of it. Okay.
And so our effort with pedestrian strands is to start thinking about it that way, to start offering that lateral experience instead of simply going across the bridge. The bridges over 670 are a specific kind of experience where you might not notice that you're going over them because you're looking in the you're looking across to see where you're going, and they're not like big expanses over a river or something.
Not counting the bridges you've worked on, do you have a favorite bridge in Kansas City?
Wow. You know, probably the ASB bridge. It's quite an amazing contraption.
Locate us. Where are we when we're on the ASB bridge?
You're going across the Missouri. It was replaced. Its vehicular traffic was replaced by the Heart of America Bridge, which extends Oak across to Burlington in North Kansas City, and it's right to the west of that.
What does the ASB bridge look like?
It's a truss bridge. It's got great big wheels on the top and these huge counterweights that lift the bottom part of the bridge, which is a railroad track, up for barge traffic and river traffic. It's an amazing machine.
It looks like it's got levels in some way.
It's got levels?
Yes.
Well, you know, there was an upper deck.
I'm laughing because I realized that sounded kind of Seinfeldian.
Well, yeah. It's levels. There was an upper deck that was a highway bridge across the thing, and I often, when I'm in the next to the cold storage building on 3rd Street, I try to remember what the approaches to that bridge were and what it was like, because it was quite a quite an interesting thing to drive across that bridge.
Why?
Well, it was originally a two-lane roadbed, and they added two more lanes on the outside of the bridge, which have been now taken off. And it was as close to parallel parking as crossing a bridge could be.
What do you like about it now?
It's an artifact. It still works as a railroad bridge, and it's still in use, but it's a remnant of a way of building, and it's really interesting when you put Heart of America Bridge right next to it, which is one of those bridges you really don't even notice that you're on because it's so precise in its engineering. It's just a continuation of a road. And then right next to it is what we used to have to do to get across the river.
Well, if you have a favorite bridge in Kansas City, one that inspires warm feelings or civic pride or nostalgia or whatever, call us and tell us what it is about that bridge that means something to you at 816-235-2888. And if you have a bridge complaint, we can take that too. Because I'm going to turn now to someone from the city. Sherry McIntyre is the Director of Public Works. Hi, Sherry.
Hi.
So what is your favorite bridge in Kansas City as a civilian traversing the city?
I think my favorite bridge would be the Broadway Bridge and then the Railroad Hannibal Bridge right next to it.
Why? What do you like about this?
Well, I like the arch look, the alignment of the Broadway Bridge. It has such unique views as you're, especially if you're traversing from the north to the south, you see the bridge at a side view, and then all of a sudden you're upon the bridge because you've had to make the maneuver. And so you get to have a view of the unique three arches and their different heights on the arches.
A view of the bridge itself.
Yes, the view of the bridge itself. You have a great view of the bridge as you're coming south. You see the bridge on the side view at an angle. You get to see all the arches.
Why do we want to see that? I mean, I think we do. I think like the Golden Gate Bridge exists and is monumental and a symbol that people all over the world recognize because we love to, for some reason with bridges, look at what makes them work and have that accentuated in some way, but we don't love that with everything.
Well, I think that the large span bridges, and as Jim alluded to, the river bridges in our area are their larger span bridges, so they create more of a sense of location and where they're at. And somewhat because we have the multiple bridges crossing the river, you do have the view of the bridges. And I think bridges in a lot of cases are viewed most entertainingly from the side. If you look at the artistic pictures of bridges, you don't see them as you're driving across them. You see them from the side view and what they look like from the side and the area and the purpose that they serve. I agree the ASB bridge is really cool. My favorite thing about some of the bridges, the ASB and the Hanwell Bridge, is the fact that they're movable bridges. And when they are actually in functionality of raising their decks up to allow the river traffic to happen is a really unique aspect and fun to see as part of what is history. Most bridges we build now, we build them high enough that you don't have to have movable bridges. So seeing those bridges actually in functionality and moving is always entertaining to me. To see the Hanwell Bridge where the ASB bridge raises up, the Hanwell Bridge turns and goes and moves 90 degrees. You don't see it that often, but boy, I think it's a unique experience when you actually get to be down in that area and you see that bridge in its moved condition on either one of them, but especially the one that turns, because you just don't see it that often.
I think the Broadway Bridge is a really beautiful thing. When you're coming in from the north, you're trying to kind of orient yourself with the north-south grid of the city, and we realize that the market area is more oriented directly with the river and kind of skewed off at an angle, and the trying to locate yourself in relationship to the bridge you're getting ready to cross is a bit of a conundrum, right? You can't quite figure out where you're going to go until you get really close and the road swings around and you realize that you're coming across at an angle.
So, Sherry, is greatness what we're striving for as a city when we need to repair or replace a bridge? Or should our goals be more practical and basic, as in, please God, just don't crumble on us?
I think there's a place for both. That, you know, some bridges, and we are working with the community to identify the ones that should create a sense of place, a sense of crossing, and identification of the area you're in. And then there's other ones. I mean, one, financially, we can't do that on every bridge. But there are other ones that you just need to know, you know, you're just crossing something. And you shouldn't really have a feel that you're going from one place to another place, because those tend to be your shorter, smaller bridges. You need to make sure that all the bridges have good accessibility and that, you know, you feel connected on both sides of a bridge.
Why is it that Kansas City bridges need to be demolished and rebuilt seemingly as part of their natural life cycles? I mean, the Hannibal Bridge, which you mentioned, was the first in Kansas City, built in 1869, rebuilt in 1917, carrying rail traffic alongside the Broadway Bridge now. The Paseo Bridge was rebuilt as the Bond Bridge with its trademark cables. Is this just a part of being a bridge?
It's part of the cost investment basis. I mean, all activities and all man-made structures eventually either have to be rebuilt or they're worn out. The materials can't handle the load anymore. Unfortunately, the loads on the vehicles that are crossing these structures are increasing more than was ever intended for carrying the capacity across them, not only from the number of vehicles sitting on them, but also, like I said, the truck traffic and the volume and the weight that our trucks are carrying nowadays is really pushing us on our bridge design.
When KCUR's Central Standard returns, your favorite bridges and your bridge complaints, you can share those with Kansas City's Director of Public Works coming right up. 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman, back in a minute. Hello again. I'm Gina Kaufman, and this is KCUR's Central Standard. We're talking this morning with Kansas City's Director of Public Works, Sherry McIntyre, and artist Jim Woodfill about bridges here in town. And I'm interested that so far, you know, well, I'd like to remind our listeners that you can join our conversation at 816-235-2888 if you have a favorite bridge you want to tell us about. But I'm interested that pedestrian traffic is so much of what's come up in terms of new bridge projects in Kansas City. And I wonder if, Sherry, is that a priority of the city, facilitating pedestrian and maybe even bike traffic across bridges?
It is a definite priority for us that we have a connected city. We have sidewalks as part of our standard roadway design, and we need to make sure that we have the sidewalks that are also allowing you to cross the bridges. For example, the bridges we've been replacing with the Main Street Bridge and the Grand Avenue Bridge, a lot of those bridges were highway bridges and they were built by the Missouri Department of Transportation, and they did not have a priority for pedestrians at that time. They were a vehicular organization. They are changing their standards as well, but it's always been the city's goal to have well-connected sidewalks throughout our city, and bridges are identified as a barrier, and so we are very much focusing as we improve these bridges that we will make sure that we have good pedestrian and bicycle access across these bridges.
This project that kind of inspired our conversation, the Grand Boulevard Bridge, which was demolished sort of suddenly to for most people's perspective in August, starting in August, and then we have a new bridge that is now open and in use a few months later. If you will forgive me for saying so, I can't prove this, but I feel like, not the greatest journalistic backbone, but allow me, I feel like there are pothole covers that have sat unchanged in our city for longer than it took to demolish, design and rebuild a bridge with a public art component. But it seems shocking to me that you can do it that fast.
Well, when you have commitment and resources, you can do a lot of things fast. Now, the advantage that we had with this bridge, one, there was a commitment by the Missouri Department of Transportation to have this bridge open by December 1st. And so that meant that we also had to make sure we made quick decisions. A lot of times we get slowed down, rightfully so, working with the community, trying to identify the assets that they want. In this case, with the Grand Avenue Bridge, it was a quick commitment that we as a city wanted to make sure that we had good pedestrian connections. We had previous designs and conversations of what bicycle accessibility we needed on the Grand Bridge because we had visioned grand improvements. So we worked to make sure we included those aspects. But it was a commitment that the city made to have the activities with having the plan for the pedestrian and the strands on the bridge. It was quick and easy to go back and make sure that we had to make sure we maintained that artistic components. And then it was a conversations between the downtown area as well as the Crossroads area, what other aesthetics did we want to do. And it facilitated the opportunity to make quick decisions because you had to make a decision and you didn't look back.
There was an emergency.
There was. In a lot of cases, we do get bogged down working with multiple agencies, multiple organizations, and lots of different views. And how do we coalesce those views into one vision of where we are heading?
It sounds like there's a lot to be learned, but though possibly from how quickly things were possible.
There is, and it was you know, I would really want to commend Eldorado Architects for working on the pedestrian strands aspect of this bridge, because we knew, you know, we were quickly mobilized to talk to the community organizations that were involved and to try to pull together a group of stakeholders and concerned citizens of what we needed to address, and we were up and running really quickly.
Jim, as like not an engineer but an artist, someone who doesn't come from a background in departments of transportation and those kinds of organizations, has working on bridge projects over the last 10 some years given you insight as like a layperson into what it takes to build a bridge?
Oh, absolutely. It's a complex problem, as is any construction project. But it gives me a lot of pleasure in my work to find shared authorship and kind of pride in construction with the construction companies that work on the projects, with Public Works and MoDOT especially, that we've been able to find usefulness and a kind of a pragmatism in the inclusion of public art with these projects.
I want to talk to you guys about landmark bridges. Is there a difference between, you know, I mean, there is obviously a difference between a quote unquote ordinary bridge and a landmark bridge. Does that have more to do with the opportunity of a bridge's location or some sort of intention on the part of whoever's building the bridge? Like, this bridge is not just going to go from point A to point B. This bridge is going to be a bridge with a name that people talk about. Like the ones we've discussed, the ASB Bridge, the Heart of America Bridge, the Hannibal Bridge.
I think there is, based on the community values that do help us decide what's a landmark bridge and what's the values of the location. We have some basic design issues that we're concerned. We know where we're at, that these are definitely areas we're going to put more effort and more financial resources towards those iconic structures. The Brush Creek bridges, the Heart of, you know, the Parkway and Boulevard bridges. It was intentional that we did the Bruce Watkins free, you know, highway as intentional, iconic, better looking bridges than average. So there's just certain areas you start into, and then there are the ones that are just, you, it's functional.
There's a bridge that our producer likes. It is going over East Gregory Boulevard, just about 700 feet west of the 435 on ramp. It's very close to the Swope Golf Course, and I'm going to try to describe this. I mean, it's over a part of the street that is just surrounded by kind of greenery and landscape. I mean, not this time of year, it wouldn't be green, but, you know, just like the growing weeds and grasses and trees, rocks. There isn't a lot that you see around it. I mean, it's except that there's this sort of tall arch that goes over it, and it looks like a very narrow precipice on that bridge going over the street. Can you tell me about this bridge?
Well, there's different design types that have occurred throughout history, and there's the functionality of what's the most effective way of engineering and carrying the load. The arch structures were a very iconic structure that was built even 100 years ago. And it's the arch structures are good at carrying loads. So there's different components on what you have for your design features, what's your span, what's your needs, and what's your components and your ability at the time. So arch structures, I think the curvilinear aspects of arches are always visually something that we appeal to our sense of view, and there's creations. I think the arch structure he's talking about is also very tall.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it creates a sense of place from, again, you're looking at it from the side. So you get to see and experience the bridge in a different way.
I know the bridge, and is it a railroad?
It is.
It is a railroad bridge, and there's a little bit of an unexpected kind of absurdity to encountering it, and it really
what
sparks.
I mean, I agree. What is absurd about it?
Well, it's just really tall, and it's and you don't expect it, and you come around the curve, and there it is, and it's. And it's a bit of a
there's not a lot of other structure around it, so it just seems like it's out of nowhere, like you're on Mr. Rogers.
And what's it doing way up there? It's it sparks our imagination mm-hmm. and a sense of wonder.
Yeah.
And the best bridges, I mean, bridges are a problem-solving thing, right? You need to get from point A to point B. And the most intriguing bridges are when you get a sense that this problem has been solved in a new way, that it's not just kind of a typical solution, that something new is being tried. And we have a good history of those attempts, I think, with our bridges across the river.
Well, in this one, you kind of wonder, what is point A, what is point B? Because you can't see them.
That's right.
There's a bridge. I mean, there are actually a couple bridges that I'm curious about. The Fairfax Bridge and the Platte Purchase Bridge that once, you know, combined to connect U.S. 69 with Interstate 635, those are slated to be replaced with a pretty significant project, you know, the U.S. 69 Bridges Project. Can you tell me about that, Sherry?
I don't have as much detail as I could. I know that that was a joint project with Missouri Department of Transportation and KDOT as the serving of those bridges. And those bridges were originally the large truss type bridges, and sometimes we have parallel bridges on these structures, and sometimes you tear down the one next to it because they serve both directional and north south and serve different directions, and sometimes you want to rebuild the companion bridge so that it looks the same, and that means you go back into what was a very popular, again, older design, was the old truss bridges. We don't build typically too many of them anymore. It's not an efficient use of materials, but you want to create the same similar look. So sometimes you're replacing one older bridge next to a new one.
What does a truss bridge look like?
Truss bridges are basically, in a lot of cases, old triangles or old squares that were built out of steel that kind of continue to add to the size of those triangles to continue to make them bigger. Almost building like with the old Kinex type toys.
You're
building
the
structures.
Set.
Yeah.
It's an erector set.
type structure.
Really?
It's an efficient way of being able to construct it out in the field. You use a lot of steel. You got pivot points, and it was easy to design where you didn't need the computer calculations to design the loads. It was easier for the time to carry those loads and calculate them. So if so I don't know if they're replacing them with one to look like the other one, because I thought they were replacing one direction only. So sometimes, like I said, you try to match them up so they look the same. A similar scenario is the 291 bridges over the Missouri River. You had an old truss bridge, and then I think in the 1990s, they built a parallel truss bridge.
So you're saying that we like the look of these older bridges, which is why we will sometimes build a newer, more efficient bridge alongside it and leave it there. But that is sort of interesting to me. I mean, at the time that those old truss bridges were built, was there some sort of marvel at the ability of humankind to construct these feats of engineering that resulted? I mean, because what you're talking about, I had thought before this show that what we liked about bridges was our positioning in the landscape. But it seems more and more to me that what we like is to marvel at our own ability to build.
Oh, yes. It is the marvel of what to build. If you look at the history of bridges, the marvel was who could one, build the longer span. I mean, you go back to the Golden Gate Bridge. I mean, the Golden Gate Bridge, the goal was to, one, it connected through there, and it was the feet. Could we cross that location? And then the old goal was also in that design, could we build the longest span bridge in the world at the time while we needed to solve the problem? So, I mean, there's been competitions, there's been looks. I mean, there's iconic bridges all over that people just know. You can show a picture of them and you know where you're at. The Golden Gate being one of them. The Brooklyn Bridge. All those aspects were all designed with ideas of, one, they were knowing they were building iconic structures. And there was also competition of, can I build it? Can I build a longer span? And what's the best way to do it?
I think Heart of America Bridge is a real interesting bridge in this discussion, because again, it's so normal, and
normal in what way?
Well, in that when you're on it, you don't experience the bridgeness mm-hmm. of it. You experience the roadway, and I think we've gotten really good at turning our infrastructure a little bit invisible, and I like the idea that we reignite. That we reignite our love of the way we build things.
Jim Woodfill, Sherry McIntyre, this has been a great discussion about Kansas City's bridges. Thank you both so much. I'm Gina Kaufman, and now we're going from bridges to seeds. Why some Kansas Cityans are saving and trading seeds when KCUR's Central Standard returns. We're back. This is KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. Now we're going to meet someone with a passion for seeds. And yes, we know it's the dead of winter, not gardening season, which is exactly why this is the time for seed enthusiasts to plant ideas for their next harvest. Dana McDaniel is the president of Seed Savers KC, and she's here with us now. Hi, Dana.
Hi.
Tell me a little bit about yourself and how you got into gardening.
Oh, I've been gardening since I was a child. My parents were avid gardeners, and Grandma was a gardener, and she's the one that was the seed saver. So
tell me about her.
Oh, that was my Grandma Jensen. She's up in Iowa, up in heaven now, but that's where she grew up at, in the Fort Dodge area. And I can remember when I was little going down into her basement and seeing jars with seeds in them on the shelf. And I thought that was such a strange place for seeds to be. And she explained to me that you needed to keep them down where it was cool and dry, and the basement worked good. And so she kind of sparked that interest at a very young age in me.
Yeah, she didn't go to the store and buy packets of seeds?
She did some, but then she saved her own as well. So it was sort of a combination of her seed use.
So explain to me why people might want to save their own seeds.
Oh, my gosh. The list is huge. We have connections to our past, and we have stories, and each seed has a story. And those stories go way back into our heritage.
Can you give me an example of a seed and the story it tells, just from your own experience as a gardener and seed saver?
Oh, I have a special one. Yellow currant tomato. Many years ago, for a very brief time, I met a very elderly woman who had the most glorious garden. And she, when she met me, her tomatoes were prolifically producing these great little clusters of these wonderful dark yellow tomatoes. And when I popped one in my mouth, it was more like eating a grape. It was so sweet. And I was just blown away. And she said, but you must save them and pass them on to others. And so I was like, well, sure, that's cool. I had gotten into swapping seeds with people through the snail mail. And so I thought, well, this would be a great thing. I can do this. And she said, but this is important. Because she'd brought these seeds with her when she was a girl, before she got married, from Arkansas up to Kansas City. And she'd grown them for years and years and years and years. And none of her family would pass them on. So I thought, this is easy. This is a snap. And when I went back a couple of weeks later to visit her, she had passed away. And so I had, this is awful. I don't even have her name. I was so excited when she said, come in and see my garden. I didn't even ask her name. And now she's gone. And so I knew then that I had to pass these seeds on. And I've passed on hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them every year since then.
How do you do that? I mean, because for a lot of people, for sort of a casual gardener, it might look something like this. You go to the store, you buy a packet of seeds, you plant them. The seeds turn into something if you're lucky, if you follow through on all of your plans and if the weather and bugs cooperate. And then by the end of that season, things die and you just start over next time. There's a whole other thing going on here. And I'd like you to explain how it works.
Well, when you become a seed saver, it's an addiction. It's an illness, but it's a good illness to have. And you learn. You broaden your horizons tremendously because you're going to learn about nature. You're going to learn about botany. You're going to really delve deep into science, which is a good thing for us to learn more about. A lot of us have forgotten the things we learned in science. And when you do that, you're going to find out tomatoes are an easy crop to save. So we have different categories, easy, intermediate, and advanced. They're easy.
Like ski slopes.
Yes, definitely. We just don't have colors on them. And so you're going to let your tomatoes get ripe, fully ripe, and you're going to get to eat them. But before you eat them, you're going to squish out the seeds into a little jar, and you're going to let those ferment. And the reason we let them ferment is the seeds have a coating on them, like a little gel coating on the outside. Well, that inhibits germination for the next season, and it also can trap some bacteria that's really bad called damp off.
You say let them ferment. I mean, it's as simple as that? You just let it happen?
Yes, it's just what nature would do. We're just duplicating nature.
So you just stick them in a jar and they ferment if you let them.
Right. You're going to let the juices, you don't actually need the flesh. You just need the juices and the seeds with the gel around them. And have to have at least a half inch tall amount of them in a jar. Just set them outside for 3 days and they'll ferment.
Okay, so what happens? After they've fermented, what next?
Then you're going to rinse them really good. So you're going to add water. You're going to agitate them with a fork. And when you do that, all the gel coatings will have loosened from the fermentation, and the good seeds will just drop to the bottom. And so then you're going to take and, with your fork, scoop off some of the crud that floats to the top and then rinse them several times, run them through a sieve, and pour them out on a screen to dry. And they're ready for next year.
So do you basically have like a seed library at your house?
Oh, yes. My basement.
Describe that for me.
I have, I don't know how many containers. And you have to use airtight containers. So they aren't just snap lids. They're snap lids with a little microfoam lining in them. So that way they're airtight. I have numerous containers with all different kinds of seeds in categories, and all of those seeds come to the big seed library, which is across the street at the Discovery Center.
Across the street from the station.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So you have this whole seed library, but in order for there to be a seed exchange, as there is going to be at the Discovery Center in January, there has to be a significant number of people doing this. Is this a pretty popular activity, or is it sort of a niche thing?
It's kind of a niche thing, but we've only been doing it for as specifically a seed exchange since 2012. But we have been doing it for 13 years through a plant and seed exchange. And at one time at our seed exchange, we had over 450 people show up. So that's a little bit bigger than a niche, but it's not like thousands, but it's still a pretty good chunk.
So what kinds of seeds have you discovered by exchanging seeds with other people who have this passion for not just sort of like species of plant or species of, you know, whatever, but of really specific, like a seed that has a story, that has, you know what this tomato is going to taste like, you know who used to grow it, that kind of thing.
Oh my gosh, there's so many of those. I've met people all over the world and traded seeds. But there's literally hundreds of stories I could tell you about seeds. But the connection that you have with the people when you trade the seeds, you not only learn the story of that seed, but you learn about those people. I met Melanie from Maine. And Melanie does greyhound rescue. And Melanie has a heart so big. She just has so much room for love in that heart. And she's a seed saver. And she sent me some Sicilian parsley, which was just this delightful parsley. And I've grown it for a number of years. And it was something that was passed down from her family because she's Sicilian. But it's just one story after another. And she told me in great detail a recipe that her grandmother had given her for a spaghetti sauce and when exactly you put the parsley in there. And it's those stories just warm your heart.
And do you grow that parsley now yourself?
Yes, I do.
Do you make that spaghetti sauce?
I'm not very good at making spaghetti sauce, but I have tried it. I don't think I made it like her grandmother.
So I've noticed that in addition to swapping seeds, people can swap other things at the seed exchange too. And I was kind of fascinated by the variety of things that, might be shared interests among this certain group of people. Like you've got the cuttings and the bulbs, but also fresh eggs.
Yes, most definitely. We have lots of people in our group that are very much going back to living off the land. And so some of them have homesteading experience that they're working on.
What do you mean by that? Because when you say homesteading, I find my imagination squarely in the 19th century.
Oh, it actually, part of it is there. You're doing skills that our ancestors have done for hundreds of years. And we've kind of gotten away from them. From mid-century time on, things have changed. We've gotten very modern. But there are things that we can still do that are great skills to have. Some of them are husbandry of animals. And eggs. Eggs are a marvelous food. They're very nutritious. And chickens are fun to have on your homestead or in your yard. And so many, many people in Kansas City now are doing that.
I once briefly worked on a farm. I wasn't very good at it, but I will say that my experience of chickens was not particularly that they were fun. I liked having fresh eggs, but I will argue about the funness of chickens.
That's the problem. You probably talk about a rooster, aren't you?
No, I mean, I'm talking about all kinds. They like to peck at your shoelaces. I mean, they're just...
Well, they are curious little creatures. That's one thing that's so good about when you have your own chickens and you have them outside. They're out there pecking around on the ground and they're eating bugs and grubs and things that are good protein for them. And it helps make their eggs a lot more nutritious.
Is there something you're hoping to find at this year's seed exchange?
Oh, gosh. I don't hardly take home any. I just bring lots to share. But I'm hoping for a lot of good community building.
Well, our time is up. Dana McDaniel, president of Seed Savers KC, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
You can participate in the seed exchange at the Discovery Center on January 21st. That's a Saturday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. There's a Facebook page that you can visit for more information. If you missed any of today's show on bridges and seeds, you can catch it all at kcur.org/centralstandard. We'll have the audio ready for you by the end of the day. kcur.org/centralstandard, and sign up for our podcast while you're there. If you are a podcast listener, tomorrow's show might be of special interest to you. We'll be recommending and sampling the best new podcasts of 2016. Don't miss that. And call in and tell us about your favorite. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Andrea Tudhope, Jen Chen, and Suzanne Hogan. Our interns are Aaron Pelish and Raven Brooks. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date next.